This morning, we'd like to take up another koan. This is number 17 of the Hekiganroku. Sitting long and getting tired. And the introduction, Engo's introduction, reads, cutting through nails and breaking steel. For the first time, one could be called a master of the first principle. If you run away from arrows and evade swords, you'll be a failure in Zen. The place where even a needle cannot enter, I'll leave aside for a while. But when the foaming billows wash the sky, what will you do with yourselves then? And then there's the case. A monk asks Kyorin, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? Sitting long and getting tired. This introduction, sitting long and getting tired. And it says, cutting through nails and breaking steel. What is that? It's a perfect description of Zazen. It is precisely this, that you are constantly running away from. The thing is that we can only go straight forward. Any deviation, any evasion, any hesitation, and we're lost. But this requires a kind of determination that few people have. All of our habit patterns, all of our ways of living are dedicated to comfort. They're dedicated to seeking security, absence of vulnerability. That we're looking for certainty. Doubt leaves us anxious. And we are above all looking for peace. Of course, there's nothing wrong with this. Except, the more we strive after comfort, the more uncomfortable our lives become. And it's the same. Our striving for security opens us up constantly to new threats. And as for seeking peace, how can we do that when we're constantly in the midst of a civil war? People want to find something ultimate, some ultimate rest. The best we can offer people who have died is that they rest in peace. And yet it is this search for something ultimate, this belief that time must have a stop, as Shakespeare said, is what is causing us so much anguish. As he says, if you run away from arrows and evade swords, you will be a failure in Zen. And what is that? What are those arrows and swords? It is that piercing sense of humiliation, that biting feeling of failure, that burning sensation of profound disappointment. It's this that we evade, we gloss over. We find excuses or rationalization. We resort, as Gurdjieff used to say, to that evil inner God, self-calming. And this evil inner God presides over much of our Zazen. The problem is that it is all too simple. It is all too direct. It is this, paradoxically, that causes us our anguish. We see this in our practice when we're faced with that awful sense of the desert, when our practice becomes barren, dry, hot, pointless. We're wandering along in the dust. We feel we've lost our way. We cannot understand why we're doing all of this. It's in this that the real breaking steel, cutting through nails, takes place. We often say that the work that we undertake in practice is the hardest work that we'll ever do. And it is in this, facing up to this grinding sense of uselessness, that often invades our practice. I'd like to read you something that was given to graduating students at their commencement. Unfortunately, I can't remember the man's name who gave it, but it doesn't really matter. But this was given to a whole group of eager beavers who were just about to burst into the world and set it all to rights, who were going to get hold of the tiger by the tail, who were going to be able to at last show people how it's all done. And they're told, and this could be, by the way, a perfect teisho for people who are undertaking the practice of Zen. It said a substantial part of what lies ahead of you is going to be claimed by boredom. The reason I'd like to talk to you about it today on this lofty occasion, is that I believe no liberal arts college prepares you for that eventuality. Neither the humanities nor science offers courses in boredom. At best, they may acquaint you with the sensation by incurring it. But what is a casual contact to an incurable malaise? The worst monotonous drone coming from a lectern, or the most eye-splitting textbook written in turgid English, is nothing in comparison to the psychological Sahara that starts right in your bedroom and spurns the horizon. Known under several aliases, anguish, ennui, tedium, the doldrums, humdrum, the blahs, apathy, listlessness, stolidity, lethargy, languor, etc., boredom is a complex phenomenon, and by and large a product of repetition. It would seem then that the best remedy against it would be constant inventiveness and originality. How inventive and original is the mind as you sit facing the wall with its dreams and ideas and thoughts? Anything but the boredom. That is what you, young and newfangled, would hope for. Alas, life won't supply you with that option, for life's main medium is precisely repetition. However, what he says now is important. What's good about boredom, about anguish, and the sense of meaninglessness of your own, of everybody else's existence, is that it is not a deception. Try to embrace, or let yourself be embraced by, boredom and anguish, which are larger than you anyhow. No doubt you'll find that bosom smothering, yet try to endure it as long as you can, and then some more. Above all, do not think you've goofed somewhere along the line. Don't try to retrace your steps to correct the error. No, as W.H. Auden said, believe your pain. This awful bear hug is no mistake. Nothing that disturbs you ever is. Cutting through nails. This is the problem with our Zazen. On the one hand, we're offered heaven on earth, the Pure Land. We come into Zen having read about masters that can die standing on their heads, about the samurai who can walk across a tightrope while swinging their swords. We have heard about the wonderful possibilities of awakening, and we're faced with an afternoon of Zazen. For this person, it always was the afternoon that was sheer hell. But of course, not only the afternoon, the mornings weren't too good very often either. And And as he says, don't think you've goofed. So often people come into Doc Sun and say, I've lost my way. Good. Very good. Now at last you can start practicing. As long as you know where you're going, and as long as you know how to get there, you're on the wrong track. It is precisely that sense of the futile, of the uselessness, of the pointlessness, which you're working towards. Because it is your enemy that wants the comfort. It wants the security, it wants the certainty. It is this sense of self whose very essence is the lust for peace. And necessarily, when one really works hard, when one really gives over to the practice, necessarily, there must be a profound sense of discouragement, a profound sense of the loss of the way. To constantly boost yourself with, well, it must be right because he said so, or because so many Zen masters have said so, or because I'm sure that this is something that is good for me, or whatever way that you try to give yourself another punch in the arm. All of this you're doing is siding with that sense of self. In fact, it is the very voice of the sense of self that you're hearing. It is not that we like pain. It is not that we feel that pain has somehow some salutary value. It is not that at all. As we say, there is no comfort in this life. There is no peace in this life. There is no certainty. Except in dreams, except in imagination, except, that is, that you can live an entirely superficial life, constantly sliding from one distraction to another distraction. But face on. As this writer so aptly says, this is how it is. And what is so amazing is that when we turn around and, as he says, embrace it, we find that in this is true peace, is true security, is no longer an experience that we're having. It's no longer, so to say, in this world. It is in transcending it. It is in coming home to what you essentially are. And you cannot do this as long as you live in distraction. It is an interesting and, in a way, tragic truth that we are indeed fighting constantly against our own liberation. He goes on and says, the place where even a needle cannot enter, I'll leave aside for the moment. Where is that? Where a needle cannot even enter. One of the main misunderstandings is that when we hear that dharmas here are empty, we then conceive of a world of vacuity, a world that is like a great hole in which there is nothing, a kind of space void. But on the contrary, I'm told that the word sunyata, which is translated as emptiness, can also mean full to the point of bursting. The world is full. It is so full that we call it empty. It is so full because nothing has any separate existence, because, if you like, there is nowhere for anything to be because of the fullness. We talk about the Diamond Sutra. And the diamond is the world. It is complete. It is full of richness. He says, I'll leave that aside, but when the foaming billows wash the sky, what is that? It is when you are drowning in distraction. When you're just taken over by the sheer there-ness of life. What will you do then? Perhaps we can say something about Kyoren. He was a disciple of Ummon for 21 years. And during that first 18 years, all that Ummon ever asked Kyoren was, what is it? Just imagine that. You go into Doksan. What is it? Ding-a-ling-a-ling. Day after day. Day after day. No wonder one ends trudging through the desert. And then one day, Kieran turned round and said, I understand. And Ummon said, well, why don't you show me? Demonstrate it. And so Kyoren went back for another 3 years. Anyway, he did come to deep awakening and he taught for another 40 years. And later on he said, it was only when I became 40 that my life became of one piece. Very nicely put. It was like the master that asked for a seamless monument. No cracks, no breaks. Some interesting mondos. One is where somebody asks Kieran, what is the one wellspring of Kieran? The one wellspring. The wellspring, of course, is where all the water gushes out. I don't know if you've ever come across it when you've been walking across fields and you suddenly come across this spring and this water bubbles out. It's life-giving water bubbling out. This is the wellspring of Kieran. What is the one wellspring of Kieran? Mindfulness without interruption. This is what is the basis of any spiritual life. And we started off the session by saying that so often people are content with their 20 minutes or 25 minutes in the morning. They've done their thing and they can forget it for the rest of the day. But this is such a wrong idea. If you're really mindful, you're really there, then, for the first time, you're really alive. We've pointed out before that the thing about going on holiday is not the magic of the place that you visit. Because don't forget, people come to Montreal on holiday. You know the feeling when you're walking along the beach on the first day and it's blue sky and a slight breeze and there's the water just lapping around and there's that feeling of the sand under your feet and there's just that sense, well, this is what it means to be alive. This is real life. Why? It's got nothing to do with the feeling of sand. If you're used to feeling sand, if you do it every day, you'll find that, good God, it's so irritating in between the toes. It gives you a feeling of grating between the toes. And then there's that blue sky. Why can't we get a drop of rain for a change? If only we could get a drop of rain. And that infernal sea splashing around all the time. But no, you're there and you're present. And because you're present, you're alive, you're well, you're there. You can feel that you're on holiday by the sea, on a hospital bed, I assure you. What is the one wellspring of Kieran? Mindfulness without interruption. If you haven't done it till now, then make this your single vow, that you're going to be mindful. You're going to really give your time to this. You have to really want to be mindful, because all of your habit patterns, all of your ways of being, your very sense of self, is dedicated to sleep. It is wanting to get back snuggled down again into that sense of half awakeness that we live in so much of our lives. And to struggle against that is like struggling against a very strong wind. And so you need to be determined, at least for a long while. After a while, it's quite natural. You are naturally present in a way that most people cannot imagine. But give yourself to it. We used to give little silly exercises when you were on the beginner's course, deliberately silly, wearing elastic band around your finger. It was the very unusualness of it. It was the very absurdity of it that helped it in its work, which was to remind you to wake up. Wear your watch on the other wrist. Open the door with your other hand, the one that you normally don't use. Change something. Do something different. In this way, the sort of the rut in which you slide mindlessly along in your day will be broken, and you'll have a chance to really be mindful. What is the one wellspring of Kyoran? Mindfulness without interruption. How is it with the one who drinks from this wellspring? He ladles it out according to his means. It's always available. There is a resource which is always available. You are much, much greater than you would believe. Someone asked him, "What is the marvelous medicine that the master prescribes?" And Kyoran said, "None other than the 10,000 things." So someone asked, a monk asked Kyoran, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West?" This question, of course, as you know well, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West, is essentially, what is the point of practice? What is the teaching of Zen? And as you know, as we started off by saying, we believe that it means a better life, a richer life, a life of fulfillment. But you see, as long as we chase after that, we've turned our back on the very source of that kind of life. We say ad nauseam, there is nothing that needs to be done. But you don't hear it. You don't really ask yourself, what does that mean? If you think it means doing nothing or something similar, then of course you're way off track. The master said, whatever you do is of no value. Now what are you going to do? So what are you going to do? Why does it mean, why does it say there is nothing that needs to be done? It's like the monk asked the master, what is the entrance to the way? And as you know, the master took the monk to a nearby stream. And he said, do you hear that? Hear the sound of the stream? The monk said, yes. The master said, that is the entrance to the way. What does that mean? Why is that the entrance to the way? And to really see that, to really get into it, to really get to know what that means, you must become as simple as the spring breeze. Everything else must go. Dogen's teacher in China, you remember that it was 2:30 in the morning and they were doing Zazen. And one of the monks started dropping off to sleep. And the master took off his slipper and hammered the monk with his slipper, shouting, "Don't you know? You must drop body and mind." What does it mean to drop? What is left? After you drop body and mind, what is there left? You remember that the emperor once asked a monk, "What is the light of Buddha?" And the monk turned round and left. What has that got to do with dropping body and mind? What has that got to do with the reason Bodhidharma came to the West? You see, the problem is as well that my giving teishos just complicates the issue so much. It really does. This is not Zen saying. This is how it is. How can one convey the simplicity of it in words? You hear the stream. You hear a bird sing. And in that is the whole meaning of existence. But what is there in that? You see, the problem is you take it for granted. Everything fundamental is taken for granted. But in the fact that you can see a wall, what is in that? What is that? What are you seeing? How do you see it? Again, you have to be very, very simple-minded to be able to respond to this. One tries to first of all ask, well, what does he mean? What is he getting at? Why ask that kind of question? Instead of looking. Or else one goes, well, one sees with one's eyes. Because one has been taught this. This is what one was taught. Or people say, well, no, it's not what I've been taught. It's obvious. No, it's not obvious at all. What is obvious is there are no eyes. In fact, it's obvious there's no head. If you really are there, you're reporting on what you know and not what you think you ought to know. Actually, a guy made a fortune with that. Do you know that? On seeing there's no, on having no head. But for all of his nonsense, he had got something which was good, which is true. There are no eyes. You don't see with your eyes. Look for a moment. Be honest for a moment. You're not hearing with the ears. Where are those ears? What are you hearing? How are you hearing then? How do you hear my voice? How do you feel that cushion against you? But as I say, you won't ask the question, you'll ask a dozen other different questions. This is the difficulty, that you hear what you want to hear. You know that story? The world, you know, malaria is a terrible scourge in Africa. And the World Health Organization decided they were going to do something about it, something very simple. They were going to teach the Africans to get rid of stagnant water wherever possible, to fill in the puddles and to scoop out the ditches and to get rid of stagnant water, because that is where mosquitoes breed, and that they are the cause of malaria. But the problem was, how can you teach all of these people? You can't have a lot of people going round. And so therefore they decided to make a film. And so they made a film and they showed Africans carefully scooping out the water with a can and filling in the ditch with earth and draining off stagnant ponds with sort of irrigation canals. And they went through all the possibilities and carefully recorded this on film. And then they said, OK, now we take it out and we show it to the Africans. And so they did. They visited all the villages and they projected this film. And, you know, a number of weeks went by and they went to a lot of villages until one bright spark in the World Health Organization said, well, why don't we just get some feedback on what they're getting out of this, just to be sure we're on the right track. So they asked one of the men who had been to see this film, well, what did you see? He said, a chicken. A chicken? Yeah, just a chicken. So anyway, the World Health Organization guy went back. He said he saw a chicken. What does that mean? So they decided they'd run the film again. And they did, and sure enough, for a couple of frames, there was a chicken run across the corner of the picture. That's all this guy got out of that elaborate demonstration on how to drain the ditches. All he got out of it was a chicken, because that's all that really interested him. That's all that registered with him. And unfortunately, so often I talk and I talk and I talk, and all anybody ever gets out of is a chicken. But what we're saying is very serious. This is the basis of the koan, everyday mind is the way. You don't need anything extra. This is living in the world, seeing the world, responding to the world. This is it. This is the magic of being, the miracle of awareness. See whether you can work with this in some way, with your koan. You're asking, who am I? This is not profound stuff. This is not difficult theoretical psychology or anything like it. What is the most simple aspect of all this? When you cut it all down, what are you? You can't say I'm the body. That is remembering something. It's not even a sensation. You're not even a sensation, because the sensation doesn't stay with you for a second. You're not a thought, because that is so evanescent, it's insubstantial. You're not a feeling. See it, you're not this. What are you then? Immediate, without any kind of addition. You see, this is why it takes so long, truly. It takes so long because you have to wear away, you have to erode all of your sophistication. This is why the desert, the boredom, the tediousness of the afternoon after afternoon is so precious. Because it's during that time, if you're working correctly, that means to say, if you're not trying to find some kind of distraction, if you're not trying to find some way by which you can make this into real practice, by which you can work with this boredom, This is another way of entertaining yourself, to try to find a technique by which you can deal with it, some method by which you can face it. All of this are ways of avoiding the real issue, the real pain of what is there. And if you can manage to do that, in its simplicity, in its openness, in its utter boredom, that will cut away. You'll not have any inclination to be somebody special in the world, because it's all worn down to a frazzle. So what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? Sitting long, getting tired.
Les quatre vœux.
Tous les êtres innombrables,
je vais me délibérer les passions avec les enfants. Je vais me de vaincre les barrières infinies du Dharma. Je vais me de franchir la grande voie du Bouddha. Je vais me d'atteindre tous les êtres. Je vais me de libérer les passions avec les enfants. Je vais me de vaincre les barrières infinies du Dharma. Je vais me de franchir la grande voie du Bouddha. Je vais me de atteindre tous les êtres innombrables. Je vais me libérer les passions avec les enfants. Je fais vœu de vaincre les barrières infinies du Dharma. Je fais vœu de franchir la grande voie du Bouddha. Je fais vœu de l'atteindre.